Dr. Boylan has served as a lecturer at California State University, Sacramento, University of California, Davis, and several other universities. Since 1989, Dr. Boylan has conducted research into human encounters with the star visitors. This has led to his current focus, creation of the Star Kids Project Limited, and working with these hybrid children, there's your answer, with advanced abilities and their families. He has presented papers on his research at, among other conferences, the 1992 MIT Abduction Study Conference, the 95 Cosmic Cultures International Conference at Washington, D.C. is author of three books, Close Extraterrestrial Encounters, Labor Journey to the Stars, and Project Epiphany. Dr. Boylan is president of the Star Kids Project Limited, a non-profit educational and training program for young and mature star seeds. He is also president of the Academy of Clinical Close Encounter Therapists, Inc., a non-profit educational and research organization, has conducted numerous workshops for mental health professionals on the specialized counseling for experiencers of star visitor contact. Those are serious, serious credentials about something that a lot of people have trouble taking seriously, the whole concept of star children among us now. Well, that's a big resume, no question about it. Here is Dr. Boylan. Doctor, welcome.
Art, how are you doing?
I'm just great, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing well.
Good.
It's really a pleasure to have you back on the air. I consider you the foremost person in alternative broadcasting.
Oh, thank you. All right. Well, you know, Doctor, for most people, the concept of visitation of any form is rough. The concept of interaction between humans and aliens is very difficult for them to believe, and then the idea of hybrids, I mean, of mixing and matching, and then having these mixes and matches walking among us, that's really a rough one. And I'd like to know how you came to the conclusion firmly in your mind, and you must have a deductive scientific mind, that it is so.
Well, I didn't get there quickly or easily. I started the research into people who've had encounters with the star visitors back in 89, and that was as a result of certain people that year starting to come to me with their accounts of their contacts by the star visitors, and I knew these were sound people, upstanding citizens in the community and not lunatics, and I got involved. It drew me in, the curiosity about this phenomenon and learning more about it.
There's a lot of separating of the wheat and the chaff there, though, isn't there? I mean, there are, frankly, people who either want to believe or are delusional or, you know, whatever. I mean, there's got to be that category.
Oh, yeah. I would say, and I've worked with over 400 experiencers of such contacts now, and I would say about 5% are of the people who step forward and say they have these contacts are seriously mentally ill.
That's very low.
Yeah, and there's an additional percentage, which I would find hard at the moment to quantify, of people who are sort of wannabes or take unusual circumstances and run too far with them.
Gotcha.
And decide they've had an alien encounter, as they might say it.
And
but once you move those folks aside, there's still a probably a solid 80% of the folks I've dealt with that whose accounts stand up in rigorous kinds of tests of whether they're
all right.
The truth.
All right. How? What is that process? I mean, how? I guess you can't give it all away. But generally, what is the process? How do you validate?
Well, first I check for their mental soundness. You know, as a psychologist, by education and training and many decades of experience, I know the signs to look for in that department. Then I look for the details of their account of what happened. By now I have accumulated enough experience working with accounts that I know the various races involved, their behavioral patterns, the kinds of messages they give, the kind of craft they come in, typical durations of encounters, and a lot of details, right down to some of the insignia and uniforms and so forth. And when somebody gets too far out away from this and makes up stuff that neither I nor Dr. John Mack nor Dr. Leo Frenkel or any of the other, shall we say, heavyweight people with lots and hundreds of cases under their belt and, you know, good scientific advanced training, when they get outside of, probably between the three of us, we probably have anywhere between a 1,500 and 3,000 case database. Now, you figure that's a pretty good sample of everything that's going on. And when you get outside of that with a story that's way out left field from that, then I begin to think that this person may be making it up.
All right. What about this? If there were really hybrids here, then I would guess that there would be a genetic giveaway. I mean, we've unraveled the human genome for the most part. And I know that, you know, we can look at it. The police have labs, and they can make all kinds of determinations about your genetic makeup. So if we actually had hybrids here, shouldn't they be genetically detectable as such?
Well, yes and no. Let me tell you the yes and the no of that. We're still working on human genome analysis. It turns out there are some variations just because of peoples from different parts of the planet have some variations that some people like to call race, but it's really more layered than that.
Okay.
So the human genome is not nailed down absolutely 100% yet. Granted that it's fairly well nailed down, the challenge in detecting non-human genes, I would estimate in these star kids and adult star seeds for that matter, the extraterrestrial component, the extraterrestrial genes in their overall makeup, you know, chromosomal package,
yes.
You know, perhaps is something on the order of 15 to 30%. It's not like the 50-50.
Okay. But even
but
so,
the
that's
problem
a, that's
with that is we, you know, we, the lab scientists doing a genome analysis, has to know what extraterrestrial genes look like, the genome, to kind of do a side-by-side with the standard human genome and see where these hybrids deviate. But the trouble is that the genome of certain extraterrestrial races has been worked, but all of that is extremely classified and denied in government labs. Dr. Michael Wolff, that I've associated with before his death, indeed worked on just such work and indicated the government had been at it for decades before.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Dr. Michael Wolff with the National Security Council Special Studies Group, what some people used to call MJ-12.
And so you're telling me the alien genetic makeup, in other words, they've unraveled some of its mysteries.
Yes, they, you know, they've gotten samples from cadavers of star visitors in crashed craft that have been retrieved, plus some tissue samples, you know, all it takes is a swab of the inside of your mouth from from living star visitors, typically a volunteer scientist consultant working side by side with human scientists in these classified labs, trying to pass on some high technology. So they've analyzed several, but the trouble is, you know, if you're inside such a classified facility and have the extraterrestrial genome side by side with the human to see where the deviations are, then you can do that. What you say is perfectly correct. Theoretically, it should be possible to just see how much in a hybrid kid, for example, is human and how much is extraterrestrial genes. But
yeah, I'm not a geneticist, but I mean, would a geneticist, in your view, be able to look at a hybrid's genetic makeup and say, aha, would it stand out like that? You're saying no, that it's more layered.
Well,
and
I'm not a geneticist either, but my inference from talking to Dr. Wolf, who's done these kinds of side-by-side studies, is that there's only a few places on a few genes where the deviations occur, and we know now that it doesn't take but a few changes or differences in certain parts of genes to make some profound differences in the way a person looks and operates.
I'm told we're just that close to, what, gorillas, I guess?
Well,
apes?
Chimps were about, I think, 98%.
98%.
Dolphins do very high level, too, which is another story we'll get into maybe during our time. But without that classified extraterrestrial genome information, the civilian labs out in the open can't make those side-by-side analyses.
Okay. Do you have any indication, any idea of, I mean, we talk about indigo children, star children, and that's been going on. That talk has been going on for years. Presumably, the process has been going on for years. So we might have some star adults by now, or even more. Do you know where we are with that?
Well, yeah. I use the label star seeds for the adults and star kids for the juveniles. And star seed adults are basically either star kids who've grown up, or in some cases, an adult is has an encounter with the visitors, and they do a little tweaking of the person's physiology and genetics, maybe, and they're transformed by that way. Now, how many of the population are that? I couldn't say definitively in my estimate, looking at the numbers of people I've dealt with, the number of people who've had encounter experiences and have been physically changed by those. And we can talk in a minute about some of those physical changes. Well, you know, the Roper poll estimated 1 or 2% of the population. Let's be very conservative and say 0.25% of the population have had an encounter with a star visitor or more during their lifetime.
Yes.
That would still be, in the U.S., several millions of people.
Yes.
And as I get, you know, this whole star kid, star seed stuff is real cutting edge. That's why even people who are kind of in the mainstream of ufology scratch their heads at this and say, I've not heard about this. But the impression I get from the many cases I've talked to is that a fair number of these people who've had encounters have been transformed. And what I've noticed even more is that the kids they have are transformed, are many of their kids are star kids in the sense that they have this profile of a large number of quite advanced characteristics that make them stand out from the average human.
Well, I certainly will say this, I know you're well aware, a very large percentage of abductees, very large, has had some sort of, when you really dig, has had some kind of sexual story to relate with regard to their abduction. I mean, it's been very, very, very reproductively oriented. The whole abduction phenomenon has been reproductively oriented. No question about it.
I personally, in my research, find that to be a bit overblown in terms of some of the more physical processes, but certainly a number of people have had, well, let's run a kind of typical case, you know, a thin pipette may be either inserted in their body or run through their abdominal cavity down in.
Yes.
Some reproductive material is borrowed, and what it looks like to me from the after effects is that reproductive material is taken somewhere, a little gene splicing done to splice in some extraterrestrial advanced characteristics, and put back, then the reproductive material is put back in the person, and they go on to have kids that look very normal, except they have these cluster of advanced abilities. And I draw the conclusion that there's been some genetic engineering going on and that these kids are hybrid, because not only are these characteristics enduring, but it appears that the characteristics get handed down from one generation to another. So it looks like it's kind of permanently enshrined in the genome.
Well, you know, Doctor, if all you say is so, then this is an invasion.
Well, that's a term.
It's a word.
What I see going on is a transformation. That's another word.
Huh. Well, I guess if you believe it to be benign, you'd be more likely to use that word.
Not only benign, but I would say necessary.
Uh-huh.
The way the human race has been going in its track record has made many thoughtful people get appalled. We're on a track, speaking globally, where the human race may either blow itself up or poison itself, either by weapons of mass destruction or by destruction of the environment.
Oh, I quite agree.
You know, and this track cannot go forward. I would say, if we may borrow a phrase from the United Negro College Fund, the star visitors take the point of view that a planet is a terrible thing to waste.
If you objectively look around you, and you look at the North Pole and the South Pole melting. The North Pole is virtually two-thirds melted. The South Pole is calving. I mean, it's just incredible what's going on. It's actually frightening. And then you get things like this from the journal Nature, the story that just broke over the weekend about climate change extinction, talking about within 50 years, 25% of all animals and plants being gone from the planet. Then, yes, we're not in good shape right now, Doctor. That's true. And you think that their intention is a benign one? That they're trying to help us with this?
Yeah. And let me, as long as we're blowing people's minds, let's finish the job here. I want to put this in a little historical perspective, because the typical take on the star visitor phenomenon is that, you know, one of their ships wandered around, crashed in 47, and they've been coming back ever since. This is a very telescope kind of vision of what contact between the nations out there and Earth has been like over time. The indigenous peoples all over the Earth hold in their oral traditions origin from the stars and the star people. And the star people say that same thing to people that they meet with currently, in the last 50 years. The indications are also from anthropology that there is discontinuity in the evolution picture of primates to man, the missing link problem, if you will.
Sure.
based on all this information, the picture that emerges is that the and from things like the Sumerian tablets that Zechariah Sitchin has translated, that the visitors came here millennia ago, and far from the Star Kids being their first bit of genetic engineering, the entire human race is their first bit of genetic engineering on Earth.
You believe that to be so?
Yes. That approximately 275,000 years ago, the mitochondrial research done by geneticists tracing back all humans alive today to a common maternal ancestor pegged it about 275,000 years ago to a common woman in a mother, if you will, in Africa, from which we're all descended. There is no clear predecessor for Homo sapiens. Neanderthal is not our predecessor, even though there were some Neanderthals hulking around in those days. And certainly Lucy and some of the other more primitive primates do not look anything like Homo sapiens. We essentially emerged without a immediate predecessor species about that time. And then the anthropologists, archaeologists tell us that there was another kind of sudden uptick in human development about 130,000 years ago when Homo sapiens became Homo sapiens sapiens, much less of a primitive kind of forehead, a larger brain case, and looking very much like we look today. And I would argue that that represented a second phase of bioengineering, genetic engineering, gene splicing by the visitors at that point when they saw that the earlier model was still pretty primitive. What is going on now, to jump forward from 130,000 years ago to the present time, is that Homo sapiens sapiens was a pretty good model. We've come up from the Stone Age. We've done art, technology, language, culture, music, etc. There's much good to be said about the human achievement to this point, but there are also some distressing
moments,
features, such as you've alluded to, and I have. There's still too much territoriality, warlike tendencies. In the old days, we settled arguments by putting a stone axe in the forehead of the other guy. Now we do it with weapons of mass destruction. I'm not sure that's a huge improvement in human functioning. And it is pretty evident from what Star Visitor told people and from looking at the pattern of things that they decided we need yet another upgrade from AOL 1 to AOL 9.0, if you will. And so we over first, you know, several decades back, some new model came in. But in my research into the phenomenon, around the end of the 80s, they started pouring in, and now there's an avalanche of these new type humans coming in, Star Kids, if you will.
Do you, Doctor, never have moments where you get concerned about people like David Jacobs and the things they say? In other words, that you've bought into this, but you could possibly be wrong regarding the ultimate motivation.
No, you know, David Jacobs is an historian. he's really not, he doesn't have any behavioral science background. He's not a psychologist, a psychiatrist. I would argue that the only evidence we have of star visitor contact is what people who they've contacted say, and the proper experts to be dealing with people who've been contacted are the behavioral science professionals.
Yes, indeed.
The psychologists that work with people can tell truth from falsehood, mental illness and emotional disturbance from reality, and are professionally trained enough not to be amateurs in hypnosis, not to...
However, even occasionally the experts are fooled.
That's much less likely than people that have no training at all. And within all the behavioral science community, and by that I include the many hundreds of people in the Academy of Clinical Close Encounter Therapists and John Mack's Program for Extraordinary Experience Research, these aren't just a handful of therapists and psychologists, psychotherapists, so forth, but these are hundreds of folks.
Indeed.
In a number of places in the world who have a consensus on what this is about. So this is not just my prejudice or Leo Sprinkles or John Max. This is hundreds of people who've got a consensus about
yes.
what this is about.
Yes. That's very true. Again, you know, we only know so much about this, and it may well be that somebody who is our manipulator or a group that would be our manipulators could have motives that we don't yet fully understand. That has to be allowed for as at least a possibility. For example, we do seem to be a really neat planet. When you look back on planet Earth, it does seem, unlike so many others, really green. Lots of good oxygen still, no matter what we've done. Lots of nice water and minerals, and it's a pretty decent place compared to most of what you see out there. And maybe it's prized real estate.
Well, I think that's, with all due respect, a kind of an Earth-centered viewpoint.
True.
There are billions and billions of stars out there with planets revolving around them. And the idea that Earth is a rare, unique, is something not held any longer by the astronomical community. Mm. Furthermore, the star visitors have the kind of technology to conform planets to livable conditions even when they're not currently found that way, as is currently going on with Mars. Even in the last several decades, Mars is starting to develop atmosphere and thicken up. And other changes, developing life patterns seasonally that in earlier decades astronomers did not see happening on there. The fading and coming of green with the seasons.
Since you mentioned Mars, you know,
yes.
it's quite something right now with the lander there and everything. Do you think there once was some sort of civilization on Mars in a day when it had a thick atmosphere and lots of water flowing on the surface and all the rest of it? Would that be your impression?
Well, Dr. Wolf says that is the case, and it certainly looks like, you know, what Richard Hoagland has said, the Cydonia complex is clearly not natural land features. It's artificial.
Indeed, it would seem so.
But the presence of life on there is contemporaneous. It's not dusty and eons ago. They're actively at work up there, changing Mars to make it more inhabitable, thickening up atmosphere and so forth. And you've got to marvel at the kind of people who have the technology to take on a whole planet and change its ecosystems to greater livability. And the point I was leading to in all of that is, the kind of paranoid, if you'll pardon my expression, the scenario that sees them as evil, mean invaders is ridiculous on two counts. Number one, they were here before we were,
mm-hmm.
And they bioengineered us. It doesn't make any sense to think of them as invaders.
I suppose not.
And then number two, they not only do they have access to the millions of habitable planets out there, but they have the technology to take a marginal planet and tighten up the atmosphere to where it's breathable and has enough pressure to hold down liquid water on the surface. In other words, create conditions for life. So it's not like they're, got a can with a bunch of pencils in their hand coming here saying, pretty please, can we have some of your real estate? It's just too earthbound and narrow a view of what's going on out there.
Well, all right. If they were our fathers, if they bioengineered us in the first place and have been guiding us since with changes, then what about, I mean, we are imagining them to be so far ahead of us that they are our creators. That's a long way ahead of us.
Well, let's say they're the handmaidens of creation.
The handmaidens of creation. Well, okay. That may be safer. Anyway, why haven't they done a better job? I mean, we do seem to be going down a track right now that's just way out of control. So their control has been pretty loose at best.
Yes. Well, again, the Jacob's idea that they're coming here in jackboots to run a prison camp is not the evidence at all. They come with a sense of collegiality and respect of one intelligent, conscious, spiritual life form for another. Even though they may be ahead of us technologically, that they don't culturally take the point of view that therefore that entitles them to take over and declare martial law and kick us in the butt and run the place. They clearly could do that, but they choose not to because they respect the fact that the indigenous life form, namely humans on this planet, need to find our way, and only when things get drastic as they are getting now, where we're sitting on the, with nukes on the end of intercontinental rockets aimed at each other.
The edge, very edge of abyss, yes.
And as you know, the cascade of environmental degradation on Earth is such that the Rio de Janeiro conference, the scientists said, you keep up the way you're going, and by 2025, the cascade will be unstoppable.
Yes.
Those are emergency conditions, and so they're stepping in and showing up in people's bedrooms at night and saying, we need to have a word here. And they're also trying to upgrade the genetics to make us a more peaceable, metaphysically aware, sensitive people that are not going to kill each other or kill off the Earth.
But it's not going so well right now. In other words,
the Stars kids and the Star Seeds are not the majority of the population at this point. But having worked with them, I would tell you, if those folks were the majority population, we would not have wars, we would not have environmental degradation. I've seen these kids wince at the thought of pollution going on. Some of them, practically have conniptions if their parents don't recycle cans and glass. They are very attuned to the environment. And, fights in the schoolyard, not only are they not part of them, they're appalled by the whole idea that people would deal with differences by physical force.
Well, the way the world and our country is structured, for example, right now, until they get to be representatives, senators, even into the White House, until they get into power, the way things go around here, there's not going to be a change. A lot of wincing, maybe, but no change.
Well, yes. The Star Seeds adults are going to have to become numerous enough and move into positions of power to make a difference. I would argue that some of them are already in sort of position, but not out of the closet yet.
So you see that going on.
Well made.
You see that going on now then.
There were quietly some starseed adults in certain positions of influence in the culture, and some of the experiencers who've had encounters are talking up about their encounters, including some celebrities. We've had Shirley MacLaine talk about her encounters, for example, and try to normalize it. And Roxanne Barr, I was on her program when she came out of the closet about her own experience when she was doing a program on that for those in the audience who've had experiences. And there have been others. Many, many stars are willing to say they've seen a UFO and they think this thing is real.
Yes.
But in terms of people changing fundamentally the value system by which nations and the global society operate, I would agree with you, we're not there yet. But I think there are many people in the wings who are ready to step forward at the right moment.
Once again, Dr. Boylan, Doctor, there's a lot of Bobs out there. And, you know, when we look at what's going on objectively in the world right now, and we look at the timeline, and the timeline of the apparent star children, star seed situation, it doesn't look like the timeline is fitting. It doesn't look like there's going to be movement fast enough to prevent our own extinction. It really doesn't look that way now.
Yeah.
So they're going to have to speed it up.
Well, right. And you've got some background in the speeding up dynamics in your book, which I found most interesting. and my Native American shaman friends concur that 2012 is not only an interesting date on the Mayan calendar, but pretty much the window by which we need to make changes. That's only 9 years out. looking at it just from the perspective of the way we normally time we take to make changes in our society across the board, it doesn't look like even with the avalanche of star kids coming in now, that things are going to change fast enough. But the wild card in the deck that is rising to the top rapidly is made up of two things: the Earth changes and the star visitors' presence coming out in the open. Now, by Earth changes, I'm sure your listeners are all well aware of what that means. But if there's some new people tuning in, let me just summarize it by saying this is sort of shorthand for a series of very major global tumults that will shake up society as we know it, already starting to happen, but will get more intense apparently over the next 3 years. Is the timeline I've been told. We're talking about everything from major earthquakes to tidal waves to volcanoes going off. Illnesses getting out there, but also social and political upheavals, wars, famines, pestilence. Your associate writer did a book on the superstorm.
Yes, sir.
That
is about to be a movie, by the way, called The Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah, I saw the trailers for that. That's quite outstanding. It's going to come out next May. That, I think, is based on some NASA or National Oceanic Atmospheric Scientist data models using chaos theory and high-grade computer analysis, that the effects in the Earth are such now that would take a relatively modest amount of destabilization to cascade some events. Well, it's your book. You can tell it better than I can. But why don't you quickly summarize that just as one example of how things might dramatically change almost overnight?
Oh, there are any number of ways that that can occur. I mean, the Atlantic current has been destabilizing, and of course, there could be a sudden change in its temperature with a resulting freezing, for example, of Europe and perhaps even a global superstorm. I mean, our weather is obviously undergoing a radical, rapid climate change period, and yeah, there's a lot. And socially, I could jump into every one of those fields and did in the quickening and point toward the global superstorm. I mean, it was a logical jump to write about, and it certainly does. Both of those books are absolutely representative of where I feel we're going right now. And so that really was my question. It was about the timeline. I just don't see anything challenging this direction for the world right now sufficiently to change its direction at all. And there's a lot of Bobs out there.
Yeah. Well, let me say a word about where I think the starseed, starkid thing fits in with the Earth's changes and the timeline.
Okay.
If we were just going linear, meaning using the past to predict the future, I would commit a formal act of despair, as I'm sure you would, and say, we ain't going to get there in time.
Mm-hmm.
But, as I say, the wild cards are all of these changes, both in the physical environment and in the social and political environment, that are going to destabilize the Earth, both physically and people-wise, in ways that are going to break down institutions. People aren't going to, in some cases, be able to get information the way they used to. Satellites aren't going to work. Power lines are going to be down. Government power centers are not going to be operational, and people are going to be more on their own. In such an environment, everything is up for change and having to be jury-rigged. And what I know we were taught in grad school about crisis is that it's a wonderful opportunity for change, since people have to make the changes anyway. They're ready to look at fresh new ideas, and that is where I think the star kids and star seeds, especially the adults, are going to step into the breach and have some powerful new ways of dealing with the situation that people are going to be ready to listen to.
All right.
The other wild card is the star visitor presence coming out in the open. We've had a kind of cascade of UFO visibility over the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember back 20 years ago when nobody could get a picture of a UFO. Their camera would freeze up or their video camera wouldn't work. And then after the UFO left, it would work just fine. But now people are getting miles of videotape footage of craft all over the world. Certainly the experiences are so numerous now, there have to be in the tens of millions globally, and a number of them are bold enough to come forward and tell their experiences in public settings. And
Doctor, by percentage, how many star children or seeds know fully who they are?
Well, in my research experience, I would say that most of them know they're not standard human issue. They are different. They're not general issue. Some of them have not yet woken up to why they're different, and that's why we have these Star Kid and Star Seed adult workshops for these folks to help them understand why they're different, their abilities, what they're here for. But most of them have a sense that they're not like the rest of humans, and many of them are aware of contacts from the visitors and deduce that there is some thing about that that is shaping them to be different. Some of them, of course, are quite crystal clear about who they are, where they came from, and why they're here and what their mission is. And most are kind of in the middle. They have some inklings, but they're still kind of fuzzy about it.
Earlier you mentioned Dr. Sitchin, Zacharias Sitchin, rather, and, you know, his work. Do you, for the most part, buy into it?
Well, the overarching theme that the Sumerians have a historical record of contact from the stars, that they learned from star visitors that they were bioengineered, using contemporary terms, fashioned, if you will, and that they got their culture from them. And
what about the aspect that we were designed specifically to be virtual slaves, to mine gold?
Well, the problem with Sumerian literature and ancient Middle East literature in general, and I took some courses in that when I was in seminary, is that those cultures, when they talked about old times, took a lot of literary license and took a few basic facts and built interesting and colorful stories that would stick in the mind so that they could be passed down mouth to mouth over thousands of years and not be forgotten. You cannot read the Sumerian chronicles of their origin like it's the New York Times newspaper. It is much more colorful, flavored up, changed around for dramatics, and fitting within the cultural lens of the people of those times.
So then are you suggesting, Doctor, that it's literary license? You know, the gold part?
Well, I'm saying it's not at all clear to what degree some of the aspects of the details of that chronicle of the interaction between the visitors and the proto-humans was as Sitchin is laying out the literal translation of it, but I'm saying that that is not the same as a history book. It is a literary, colorful storytelling. It may be, for example, that the star visitor group that was involved with the Sumerians did that first iteration of Homo sapiens still pretty primitive, and about all they were good for was heavy lifting. They weren't very bright, and this is about 275,000 years ago, and so if they helped out in hauling stuff out of the mines, whatever, then after allowing evolution to go on for a while, being clear that they needed an upgrading about 130,000 years ago, they did a genetic improvement, Homo sapiens sapiens, modern humans, and at that point, the intelligence level was such that it would not be appropriate to see them as a beast of burden type animal.
Well, you understand why I asked you that question, because, I mean, we're constantly looking to their, if they are our designers, their motivation. And if it is benign, it's benign. But if it's, you know, if we were slaves, then it perhaps was not at that time as benign as we would have liked it to have been. Or maybe, as you're suggesting, that's literary license in the way the story came forward.
Well, I think there's certainly a lot of literary coloration in the story, and knowing the way literature in that time is written and the cultural lens it's written from, I think we have to approach the high details with caution. That was a very vertical society. The king, strong man, ruled. Everybody else was essentially higher or lesser grades of serfs or slaves. That's how they saw society, and any story of interaction in their history is going to be told with that kind of perspective. In anthropology, we call that culture-bound thinking. It's hard to see reality outside of your own culture you're inside of. So I think the caution signals are up about taking every last detail as literal fact.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I think the primitiveness of Homo sapiens versus the higher intelligence and sophistication of Homo sapiens, modern man, suggests that the earlier version was less capable and may have needed more direction to find its place.
Mm-hmm. In your research, at some point you got diverted enough to go out actually yourself to Area 51. Is that correct?
Yes, I've been out there a number of times.
Not far from my house, as you know.
Yes, good old Perone.
Oh, yes. So what did you see there?
Well, the first time I went by there, I really feel it was guided, my timing. I happened upon some test flights of anti-gravity craft. This was April 1992. And I approached there in the afternoon, and the good old Wackenhut guards were not pleased by my approach. And my rear left tire got shot out. So I had to limp back and into the highway and do a tire change.
They shot your tire out.
Well, there were two of them, and when I drove by, my tire explosively decompressed, and it was not
a rock.
This is flat desert, uh-huh. And this was not a something I ran over. This is a sidewall rupture with violent decompression. I
uh-huh.
draw the inference that's what they did. The tumbleweed didn't do it.
But you saw gravity, anti-gravity craft. You're sure?
That night I came back with lights out and pulled back there and used binoculars, and I saw one at a time five different ships rise vertically out of Area 51 above the ridgeline of the Groom Mountain Range.
Yes.
These were discoid-shaped craft with a glowing orangish, reddish, goldish kind of ionization field all the way around them. They're very intense glow. Sit there hovering, and then after a bit slowly start tracking downrange at a constant altitude, maybe 30 miles an hour, which, as you know, is not a Piper Cub stall speed.
Doctor, I've seen them myself.
Yes, you know how it goes.
I do, and they're real. Do you
yeah,
believe them?
These are U.S., by the way, and not extraterrestrial craft.
You believe they're U.S. Craft? Test
yes.
Craft. Using our technology, Doctor?
Made
ours?
By Northrop Aerospace.
With our technology only?
No. Copycatted from extraterrestrial technology.
Back engineered.
Yes. Yes. And the reason I say that is because after I finished going there and did a loop around the southwest, I came back to northwest of Lancaster, California, up against the Tehachapi Mountain Range, where I had been told Northrop has a secret plant.
Phone lines here are ringing with an obvious urgency, so I know there are a lot of people who want to speak to Dr. Boylan, and surely we will get to that, but boy, we've got a lot of material. We really do to cover. Dr. Boylan, an eyewitness at Area 51. Doctor, I've interviewed Dr. Greer many times, and it's his feeling that we've actually shot, that our military has shot at UFOs. And I know you've written the government is violating the treaty against weapons in space. What are we doing?
Well, yes. I think it's STS-48, that famous videotape that the astronaut shot of from space of a bogey, unidentified flying object out at the edge of Earth's atmosphere. And
I believe you're referring to that item NASA calls a hunk of ice.
Yeah, well,
not,
very interesting piece of ice that suddenly does a 90-degree turn and accelerates.
It is, indeed.
Yeah. And what comes up from Earth towards it is a neutral particle beam Star Wars weapon blast.
It sure looks like it.
And, you know, that those neutral particle beams accelerate at roughly the speed of light, just slightly below, with a little bit of Earth atmosphere slowing, but pretty darn fast. In other words, folks, we're talking as fast as radio waves come at you from Art Bell Station.
Mm.
And this UFO dodges and misses the bullet coming at the speed of light towards it. You've got to figure the technology of these folks that they can detect incoming far enough ahead at the speed of light to make a evasive maneuver and get out of the line of fire. This is not a piece of frozen urine from one of the astronauts, I want to assure you.
Mm. Well, you know, you wouldn't think they'd regard that as a warm welcome or a thank you or anything.
No. There are, and I have multiple sources, including Command Sergeant Major Bob Dean and another gentleman who used to work for the Army General who first headed up the Army Space Command, that we have in orbit right now particle beam weapons, killer lasers, and electromagnetic pulse weapons. These are weapons who can emit a swamping, overwhelming force field that will fry any electronics.
Uh-huh. I believe that, and that clearly violates the treaty.
Yes, we are signatories. The U.S. is a signatory, along with most civilized nations, to a treaty saying we will not place weapons in space. Well, we signed that treaty, but behind people's backs, we've ignored it, and our military have gone up there and placed orbiting weapon systems in space, and they are directed not only to interdict intercontinental ballistic missiles, but also occasionally target incoming star visitor vessels. And some have been shot down. Leah Haley, who I believe you certainly know and may have had on your program earlier.
Indeed.
Is an eyewitness to a shoot down because she was on board an extraterrestrial craft and it was shot down near Gulf Breeze, Florida, in the Panhandle. And to refresh our listeners' memory, she was on board with some other humans who were having an encounter with the visitors when a portable electromagnetic cannon was placed on the near the beach, and the military knew ahead of time. They'd been reconnaissancing, I guess, these experiencers who had repeated visits, and they knew when the visitors were coming for them, and had a cannon along the line of path of the craft and shot it down. It landed hard on the sand. Some of the people inside were injured, and some were still okay. Leo is one of those okay. A offshore Navy vessel pulled up. I forget if it was Navy SEALs or Delta Force came up, surrounded the craft, pulled Leah and some other humans and the star visitors out of there, put them aboard a craft ship, took them out to the main vessel out there on the sea, and away they went.
When that happens to the United States, Doctor, we call it an act of war.
Right. And part of the reason I think Jacobs and the crowd that look paranoically at the visitors as an invasion force, they've had ever so many of these provocations that if it were another Earth nation would say, well, you can't do that to us. That's an act of war. But these people turn the other cheek repeatedly because, like I say, they're here as a Peace Corps to try and get us to straighten up and fly right. And they're hardly wanting to add to the violence and aggression going on. They see plenty enough of that going on Earth without any outside help. And so we do have this stuff both on Earth, stationed on Earth, pointing upward, and in space, pointing down and out.
And you believe their attitude to be one of turn the other cheek?
Yes, they've been fired on so many times, and they use their technology to evade.
Okay.
The one recorded incident, I think, of a military jet going down was decades earlier. I think it was an Iranian Air Force plane engaged a UFO.
That's right.
Did lock on with radar lock on and rockets ready to go. And the visitors on board that craft decided to deal with the F-16 not by shooting it down, but by, I guess, they swamped its electronics so everything died on the plane. Of course, modern jets, once the electronics don't work, they're hardly airworthy. They're
rocks.
Drop pretty fast.
Rocks.
And so that one went down. I think they've learned since that that's not a good nonviolent way to deal with a firing situation. Usually they just do a do-si-do and dodge real fast. But that's about the only incident I can think of a... it's not even a shoot down. It's just a nonviolent dealing with a military jet that caused a crash. And this is over thousands of engagements of military fighters with UFOs in which they've just gone away or gotten invisible or do-si-do'd and got out of the line of fire. So we're clearly not dealing with a warlike people that are looking for an excuse to blow us out of the water, because they've had plenty of those excuses and have not done so.
All right. In the past, you and I have spent a lot of time, and it's an obvious path to take when you talk about their being our creators, to talk of the church and talk of God and talk of the Bible. But instead of going down that road tonight, since we've been down it, there have been statements made by Monsignor Balducci, and I understand you may have more on that. He kind of rocked the Vatican world, didn't he?
That would be a mild statement, yes. He, and furthermore, he's kind of hanging out there, and may I say the Pope is letting him hang out there kind of by himself. There's not a whole lot of other clergy over in Rome that are going out public with this, but he has. I have the honor.
You might say he's twisting in the Vatican breeze.
Yes, that would not be unfair characterization of it all. I had the pleasure of going over there December of 2002 and meeting with Monsignor Balducci, and he graciously took us upstairs to his house, and he lives within very easy eyeshot of the Vatican, and we had a very long evening of discussion. He was just finishing a paper he was writing on UFOs and the star visitors, how this is consistent with church teachings. It doesn't represent any problem for the church. It's not forbidden by the Bible or anything else. It's consistent with what, in fact, he'd spent a lot of time saying that the early church fathers, teachers and bishops and theologians said that there is life out there, and that that's not a problem, that God made all the people on all the planets, and if I may be colloquial, no big deal, you know, take a deep breath and live with it. This is not the kind of stuff you hear from your Sunday pulpit, but it is what Monsignor is being allowed to say in Italy. And may I say that the big man, Pope John Paul II, even on one occasion squeaked out a comment of his own. He was asked during a audience by one of the people there, "Holy Father, but what about the extraterrestrials?" And his cryptic answer was, "We have to remember they are God's children too." He didn't say what extraterrestrials or, you know, they are of Satan. He just said, "We have to remember they're God's children too."
Can you recall the occasion upon which he said that?
It was during an audience. It was several years ago, maybe five or six now. I don't have the town.
To come back that affirmatively with that sort of, wow.
But while Balducci says, you know, just for those of our audience who aren't 100% up on Balducci, he says they're not demonic. People who report them are not crazy. These encounters deserve to be studied carefully. These visitors are obviously more advanced than humans. Actually, he personally kind of puts them halfway between humans and angels, some of them in their spiritual development. But the Pope, at least, while he doesn't go public and say, "Balducci's right, he's my man," he at least, when cornered himself, says, "We have to remember they're God's children too," which is a statement of affirmation and not denial.
It certainly is. It certainly is. All right. I'm going to turn a question around on you here. We have these written questions for the show, folks, and sometimes I follow them. More times I don't. But this one's kind of interesting. Questions I might ask, you know, of Dr. Boylan. You're reported to have said that some of the famous UFO investigators out there are not qualified to make statements they make about abductions. What do you mean by that, and who are some of these investigators you feel are unqualified? Now, I'm not going to ask that. instead, I'm going to ask you, there is, in ufology and in your field, our field, I guess, in general, there is more fighting that goes on generally on an NFL Sunday football game. I mean, it just is, it's rough out there. Ufology is small anyway, and in its ranks, they're ripping each other to shreds. What's going on?
Well, several things. And I would speak for the few naive people in the audience, because you know this art. First of all, it's no accident that there's a lot of turmoil. Billions of dollars are being spent to make sure that there's plenty of turmoil in this field.
Oh, you think it's orchestrated?
Some of it. Not only the disinformation boys active, but I've had them do it to me, and I've had them do it to other solid researchers. They go up to you and say, "Do you know what that other guy just said about you? I think you should know this." And then he goes up to the other person and says, "You know what Boylan said about you? I think you should know this." You know, they play the let's you and him fight game.
Yes.
And they do that in print. You know, they I've had them ask me questions on email and then take it out of context and shove it in the other person's face and saying, "He's saying dirt about you," hoping that they'll say something bad about me, and that, you know.
So you've been involved in more than your share of these little brawls.
Yeah. Also, I mean, there's that stuff going on, and that's your tax dollars at work.
Right.
Then, of course, there's human nature. You remember that, Art. And ego, pettiness, competition tendencies exist in the UFO field like they exist in the rest of human society. Plus, you've got a what I think John Mack has described very well, and I certainly agree with him, with the UFO subject, we have a subject of cosmic importance, and the star visitor contact with humanity, a subject of transcendent importance.
Agreed.
If this stuff is true, it is the biggest story that has ever been told.
Agreed.
Okay. You get Joe Sixpack out there who went to a MUFON meeting and got a card. Now he's a UFO expert, just using an illustration here. Comes to a meeting and, you know, he has his own personal opinions and somebody else says something different. And he feels this subject is too important to let this other jerk get away with his ignorance, and so he feels the need to get up and verbally beat him up at them.
Yes.
This kind of stuff goes on. So between the orchestrated, deliberate provocation stuff that the Cabal Boys, the UFO cover-up organization operatives are doing, there's plenty enough human nature. Given the importance of this subject, people tend to get grandiose and assume that it's important, therefore I'm important. If I talk about it, therefore nobody else better get in my way. And you've got the recipe for a Donnybrook.
Yep. Well, I mean, they go on so frequently that ufology already having a pretty tough time getting taken seriously has even yet more problems. I mean, how much do you attribute to an orchestration by people with money? How much of it is that? And if that were to stop, how much, what percentage of the fighting would stop? Same question, I guess.
Well, if we took all the disinformation away and what people like Dr. Michael Wolff and the National Security Council Subcommittee for Management of the UFO Matter, if the level of information they know were out there in public with no lies, deceit, denials, and distortion, just 100% out there as the fact base, society would be pretty much at one because we'd all be starting from the same page. Then we'd just, you know, have some discussion about how that affects you and me and the person down the street, but we would not have so much differences. There would still be, given the cosmic importance of this issue, people taking their positions. But I think a whole lot of the Donnybrook would settle down. What we need is leadership that is not being sabotaged. There are, as you know, are certain people in this field who stand above others
yes,
with credibility, dignity, and consistent, clear, non-combative statements of position. Somebody like Bob Dean comes to mind.
Before we proceed with a little item and then phone lines, phone calls, all of you, I do want to mention that Dr. Boylan has a website, which we have a link for, of course, coastcoastam.com, would take you to www.drboylan, that's B-O-Y-L-A-N.com. DrBoylan.com, DrBoylan.com. And he also has three books, Close Extraterrestrial Encounters, Labor Journey to the Stars, and Project Epiphany. Now, Doctor, which is your latest, Project Epiphany?
Well, as a whole book out, Project Epiphany is the latest, but I have updated Labor Journey to the Stars to a 2003 edition, so with the updates, the material in there is a little fresher than Project Epiphany.
Well, if somebody listening for the first time tonight is fascinated, and many are, by what you've been saying, and they want to do more reading, where would you suggest they start?
Well, I think Labor Journey to the Stars is the comprehensive briefing book that will get you from 0 to 65 miles an hour in the world of UFO reality.
Labored Journey to the Stars. That would be available on Amazon and
well,
so forth.
That one is self-published, so I am the principal source for that one.
Well,
the other two are commercially published.
Who and how? On your website, I guess.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. You can go to the website. It'll say one of the links there says Dr. Boylan's books. Just go there, and it'll tell you just how to order.
Do you have any operators standing by at this hour, frothing at the mouth, waiting to take a look?
I think an email would be the best, or a call in the morning would be the best way to get the order going.
Speaking of journeys to the stars, our president, coming up probably on Wednesday, is said by the Associated Press and everybody else to be about to make a proposal. It sounds like he's going to propose a manned base on the moon. That's no small undertaking. And then an eventual trip to Mars and beyond, even to the asteroids, they say, from the moon, where it would be easier. And that is said to be what the president is going to say. We don't know that for sure, but it sure looks that way. What do you make of that?
Well, in my never-ending search to push the envelope a little bit, I would say that is A, true, and B, a cover story. And the reason I say it's a cover story is that I've been informed by Dr. Wolf and others, Bob Dean's alluded to it too, that we already have a tiny station on the moon and a very minuscule forward observation post on Mars. And people say, what do you mean, Apollo 17 was the last thing we sent up to the moon? No, it is not. We have not only anti-gravity disks that hover above Area 51 and other places, but we have larger anti-gravity craft in our secret military fleet that are spacefaring, have gone out. And
but gee, Doctor, that would make the public space program a sham. It would mean that we've killed astronauts with no cause other than to maintain secrecy.
It's an elaborate cover program too. Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy is a cover program. Those rockets that blast off with extremely explosive chemicals pushing them is 1945 technology. You would think it's a bit curious that we haven't moved ahead in the last 55 years from that. Well, officially at Cape Canaveral, we haven't moved ahead. Unofficially, behind the scenes at Area 51 and King Mountain, Utah, and some other places, we have a fleet of a variety of size anti-gravity craft, some of which have gone out to the moon and Mars, and also service an undeclared space station up in space that has nothing to do with the current one being built. Has been up there for three decades. There's a whole program of secret military astronauts trained at a facility next to, but not part of, the Air Force Academy at Colorado Springs, and I've detected where that is there, done a little recon.
Oh.
And they staff flights that have gone out of Vandenberg Air Force Base and Beale Air Force Base in Northern California. Now they tend to generate out of the King Mountain facility in Utah and go up into space. Not all of them go to space. Some of them do work on Earth out in high altitude flights, recon, and occasionally military interdiction stuff.
Well, Doctor, there are many who feel I was a child when man stepped on the moon. I remember watching it on TV.
As did I.
And we haven't gone back. Man hasn't gone back to the moon or Mars or anywhere else. We have not gone anywhere since. And to many, including me, that is really suspicious.
Yes. You know, all we're allowed to do is go up to the edge of orbit in the atmosphere and float around up there and then come down. You know, it reminds me of a kid that's been told to stay in his room after he wandered too far down the block.
Exactly. And you believe that's, in essence, what we have been told?
Yes, that the star visitors are extremely unhappy with the prospect of some of the military wanting to take nukes into space.
Hmm.
And this whole John Wayne gunslinger mentality of the space is the next frontier and launch out there with our militarized craft and prepared to fire at anything that gets in our way. That is not the etiquette of space. And they've made it quite clear that until we develop our etiquette, we're not welcome out there.
So then we're being treated by the star visitors much as the Chinese treat SARS.
Elaborate that a bit, if you would.
In other words, we're quarantined.
Yes. Yes, there's a famous astronomer and ufologist to a degree. His name is starting to slip my mind here. He's an Oregon atmospheric science professor, James, last name's escaping me at the moment, Dr. James X, let's say, who had a published paper in an astronomical peer-reviewed journal making that very point, that it appears from all signs that we are under space quarantine until we clean up our act and fly right.
Mm.
And I totally agree with that. Furthermore, a number of the star visitors have told the humans that they've had encounters with that. It's not so much the cop stuff. If you can't get them out there, they're good. It's more in terms of, gee, we wish you would change your attitudes. We'd love to have you come out there as a peaceable, open-minded people and engage with us, but not with this shoot first and ask questions later attitude we seem to see in your military at this point.
Well, you would have to view us currently, I guess, objectively, you know, if you were standing back, America, that is, when I say us, as a very rather warlike people, actually.
Yes, I think, you know, when you get outside the U.S. press and read some of the world press about what they think of America's behavior, you don't have to go off planet to get that perspective.
It's true. People need to read foreign publications. It's easier to do with the internet. You need to listen to shortwave and shortwave news broadcasts and that kind of thing. And the picture of America is so different than the one projected internally. And you really can't say that's balderdash until you've tried it yourself, folks. So do a little international listening and see what you come up with. Doctor, we've got to go to the phones. I've got a lot of people waiting to talk to you. So let's see what we get. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Richard Boylan. Hello.
Is this me?
It is. Well, okay. Only you surely know that, but it sounds like you.
Okay. My name is Angelique from Utah, and I have a couple comments that I'd like to just spit at you guys and see how you guys feel about it.
Sure.
And then about star babies. And then, Mr. Bell, if you'd allow me, I have a comment about the moon or a question about the moon.
No, well, go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I would like to kind of validate Mr. Bell's feelings that star people, some of them could be ready to harm us. There could be more than one alien race with different motives, you know, per se, the Pleiadians versus the Syrians. Also, I know you didn't really want to dip into the whole biblical aspect, but Genesis 2, the sons of God breeding with the daughters of man, does give evidence of hybrids or possible evidence with the Nephilim. Also, you know, this has to do with the secret societies. And
okay, slow up a second.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Boylan, she's got a good point. Many ufologists, even some well-credentialed ones, believe there are many different races, and I've heard many different numbers, as I'm sure you have as well,
right.
And that they may not all have the benign intentions that you attribute to them.
Well, there are a number of races in contact with Earth. My guesstimate would be perhaps 100.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
They all have the right agenda.
All with the same agenda, Doctor?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you what the National Security Council's information is, that there are four federations made up of all these different folks who kind of clustered each into federations, and there's four of those. and they're all working in concert with each other to coordinate this contact. Some are doing more scientific investigations. Some are doing the people work. Some are keeping an overview on our activity at the edge of space and so forth.
But mostly that's a yes. That's a yes. You're saying they are...
They're peaceable. And further, they are dedicated to making sure that the occasional rogue operator out there that tries to sneak in and pull their stuff off is stopped and interdicted. They don't have 100% success rate, but they have a pretty good success rate. And furthermore, we're talking individual, occasional individuals, not whole invasion races.
But for the first time, I just heard you acknowledge occasional rogue operator.
Yeah, self-serving.
Okay.
And
all right.
But very few compared to the good guys.
Gotcha.
About the same percentage as my research with 400 experiencers and listening to what Dr. Sprinkle and Dr. Mack have gotten, I would estimate it's about the same percentage as in the human race, where we have about 1% sociopaths in the population.
At least.
And I would say maybe 1% rogue operators out there.
Wouldn't you agree, Doctor, that a cosmic psychopath could be potentially harmful to a lot of people on Earth versus a human psychopath? And I'm not disagreeing with you that there's probably, you know, very good aliens or angels, synonymous, that have humanity in their hearts for us. But I do believe what Dr. Bell is saying, that you know, is the possibility of them, of some of them being harmful or threatening to us, especially not even allowing us to know that we are possibly being engineered with star children. You know, there's plenty of us, including myself, call me crazy, that would probably be willing to be part of the experiment. And I know we don't tell dogs we're taking them to the vet, but at the same time, I think that, you know, some of us should be allowed to know. And I do have a couple more statements, if that's okay.
Well, we're getting close to the end here, but
okay.
Any doctor, anything on that?
Well,
the
rogue operator could obviously be unhelpful, and you know, with things like telepathic communication, a person might be caught off guard to having somebody jar them when they're not even sure where it's coming from. These, you know, the trouble, the reason I hate to talk about this is, first, there's such an infinitesimal, tiny sliver of a fraction of a percent of the whole phenomenon. And the disinformation boys run with this theme as though that was most of who's in play with Earth. And that is a total misrepresentation of what's going on.
Fair enough. And you've represented what I think you believe quite well. Young lady, anything else?
Yeah, just a few things. Some of the rumored aspects, I didn't really hear traits of the Star Children. And some of them that you know, that I've been rumored to have heard are that they have extreme difference of body temperature, like holding at 96.5, which is rare. Larger eyes, like the gray, smaller mouths, advanced motor skills as children, but late talkers. We've had the highest incidence of diagnosis in history for autism, and then they end up being perfectly normal, possibly hinting to telepathic talk between these children, or that they might assume that we can from birth, and then they, you know, come into their earthly state of knowing.
All right, hold it there for a moment. Doctor, is that a fair description at all of some of the qualities of the Star Children?
Some of them, yes. There are a lot of them. I've enumerated 54 characteristics, and if some of our listeners would like to see all 54, since we're not going to have the time tonight to get to them, they can go to the Star Kid Identification Questionnaire on my website and look at all 54 characteristics. What I found is, yes, indeed, many of the star kids and adult star seeds have body temperature that's a degree or two lower than normal.
Uh-huh.
Instead of the 98.6 on the thermometer, well, like I read at 96.8, and others read in the 97s and 96s.
I read even a little lower than you do.
Well, my friend, that tells me something about you. And by the way, I doused your photo. You know, people know about these dousing rods. Everybody throws a bioelectric field out, and what I found is the fields have flavor to them. In other words, the field of a bad guy is different than the field of a good guy, and aren't you come out on the good guy side of the equation?
Do I?
Yes, you do, my friend.
Well, that's kind of neat to know. You can get that from a photograph. In other words,
I've learned that recently. You know, I've done it with live people, and I've watched the way the rods behave, and I've learned it works with photographs. And there's the good guy and the bad guy profile on what the rods do, people in live in front of you and in the photographs as well.
So the implication is then that that energy is able to be captured by the photographic process.
Yes. You know, the shamans, the so-called primitive peoples, North American Indians, African tribes, so forth, the shamans know that you have to be careful with photographic images because they're so like
the
person looks.
That's true. Dr. Boylan, there's a cyclone of talk going on in the paranormal community and some of the scientific community right now about Yellowstone. It's all over the community. What do you know, if anything, about Yellowstone and what might be going on?
Well, there is increasing geothermal activity underneath Yellowstone. You know, until recently, I didn't appreciate. You know, you can get educated on the internet.
Mm.
The Yellowstone, besides being a very pretty national park, is a super volcano caldera, basically. The remnants of a volcano that is kind of eroded down, so it's not obvious. You don't go in there and see a typical cone-shaped volcanic mound. It erupted in the past and kind of blew off the top. The reason there's so many hot springs there is that basically the magma, the hot rock melted under the Earth's crust, is very close to the surface, as you might expect in a historical volcano. And when water percolates down through the rock and hits that, up comes these geysers that are all over the place there. Recent indications are that the magma is on the move back towards the surface. When magma hits the surface, we know that as lava and eruptions. The waters have gotten warmer in some of the bodies of water in the park. The geysers are getting irregular. Sometimes the ground itself is hot enough that it's uncomfortable to walk on. There are a number of indicators that it is getting, the magma is getting close to the surface, and this is typically the sign that a breakthrough is in the offing.
It would be catastrophic. People,
yeah.
I don't think generally do understand how catastrophic it potentially could be. Now, have Native American shaman told you that this is foretold?
Well, the scenario of a lot of volcanoes going off is certainly foretold, and my chief contact, Standing Elk, now known as Golden Eagle, the Dakota Sioux star altar keeper, got some information that some volcanic activity would be happening in the very near future. And we have to understand that Yellowstone is not just your garden variety volcano, it's one of these super volcanoes. In other words, when it corks off, it's going to make Mount St. Helens look like a hiccup. It is truly catastrophic in scale. When these super volcanoes go off, they throw so much material into the atmosphere that you get a super cooling effect. So much sunlight gets blocked out, and this stuff carries downwind and to a lesser degree around the globe. It has been estimated that when Yellowstone cooks off, it will change the climate in that part of the United States.
Oh, yes.
It will make certain areas uninhabitable. There'll be so much ash that farming and other activities won't be able to be done in downwind of there. And we're not talking yards. We're talking apparently several states.
Yes.
And maybe a larger swath than that. There could be at least temporary climate change. And
so you're talking about changes of the magnitude that we were discussing earlier that would begin to bring about this acceleration of change to catch up.
We would have change on the order that FEMA could not handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And the beginning of breakdown of regular, expectable society in that part of the American West would not happen. You would have things like economic collapse, farming and ranching in that area not able to go forward any longer, massive loss of probably some power-generating facilities in that area. The ash could bring down airliners and certainly make it difficult to fly in that general area, etc. We're talking about major disruption and likely to go on for years, not just weeks.
And they say soon.
Yeah.
Do they give you any sense of the magnitude? You said they indicated there would be volcanic activity there soon. Was it of the kind of magnitude you just described, or...
Well, they're talking in general about volcanism in the world, and particularly in North America, which is where these native peoples live, that will be distinctly noticeable. You know, different tribes get different indications about different mountain volcanic regions.
Right, but what I'm getting to is not necessarily the big one, but activity.
Yeah, but enough. On a scale enough that it will disrupt ordinary life in that region, not just be an inconvenience for a week or some village having to dodge lava. We're talking about regional level scale disruption and for a long time.
Any idea what it would be like, say, where I'm located?
Well, I don't know the volcanism story around Pahrump.
Well, I wasn't thinking so much of immediate lava, but I mean the fallout, we're not that far.
But you tend to be upwind, I think, of Yellowstone in general.
There you go. That sounds positive.
But,
all right.
I think the thing you've got to worry about more, and so do I, is the tectonic plate activity where the Pacific and North American plates meet.
Ah,
that
yes.
When the big ones happen along the California, Oregon, Washington coast, line or inland a little bit, you'll probably feel it over at Pahrump, even though the epicenter may be closer to the San Andreas Fault or some of the other coastal faults.
All right. Sounds like I might make it.
Oh, I think you'll make it, but I would keep your surfboard handy.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Richard Boylan. Hello.
Yes, sir. You're scaring me. I'm in Vancouver, Washington.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Doctor, I'm curious to know how we communicate with the average alien, and is that telepathically? Or, of course, when these star children come here, they've got to learn English, don't they?
Well, the star kids are here already. I mean, they're born to a perfectly normal-looking mom and dad, and they look passably human, too. Sometimes they have slightly larger heads, and they have some of these ESP abilities and a few other characteristics like lower body temperature, and they put out those orange sodium vapor street lights when they go down the street sometimes. Their field interferes with that light bulbs feel. But they pass for, you know, just to eyeball them, they pass for normal in the classroom and on the street. Where the kids get to know that they're different is their extreme intelligence, their disinterest in the kind of stuff some kids are into, you know, fights and
yes,
competitiveness, their
socially
concern
distinct
for the environment. They're they're globally aware. They care very much what's happening halfway around the world, whereas the average kid's worried about when he's going to get his new video game. They're thinking big. They're thinking more like adults than kids. They just are in a different frame than the average kid, and the average kid picks up on it and says they're weird, they're odd. You know, they find it more. The star kids find it more difficult to fit in and look conventional. Some of them have told me they work very hard at trying to play cool and play like the average human, so that people won't know they're different. But deep down inside, they know they just are put together different and think and feel differently.
There is that class. I mean, I know who you're talking about, Doctor. I really do. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Richard Boylan. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question is, when you were talking about the Sumerians and the gold and how, you know, it's a lot of artistic privilege, it made me really curious if you've read any of Lawrence Gardner's work on the monatomical gold.
On the monatomical?
Well, the monatomical elements of the platinum group, okay. Specifically the gold that was used for, you know, the cancer cures and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
You're talking about Ark of the Covenant, that
yeah,
far back
pretty
kind
much,
of stuff?
Yeah, David Hudson rediscovered it down in Arizona.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, and there's some indication they think that's the manna of the Old Testament times,
right. And
some of the material that was used for some of the miracles in biblical ancient times.
Right. So I was
yeah,
just
I'm,
wondering
I'm aware of,
with the
of that.
Getting that for them. So.
I respectfully listen to that information, Hudson's and Gardner's. I'm always, as a scientist, looking for the evidence. I of course read the Bible many times, and it could be that monatomic platinum class metals were the element that had strange and curative properties that were used to do some of these miraculous things. But I always look for the evidence, and how do we cinch it that was indeed what manna was, or what was used by some of the ancient biblical folks to work the wonders that were worked.
And there's not enough evidence of that yet?
It's not cinched in my book. I don't throw it out, but, you know, in this field you have to have a large gray basket. You know, there's the white basket, absolute truth, and the black basket,
yes,
absolute falsehood. But
yes,
the largest basket's gray. Like, well, let me think about that, and I'll get back to you when there's a little more evidence.
All right, Stanton's gray box. There you go.
Okay, can I ask you one more fast question?
Yes.
Are the grays, you know, the gray beings?
Yes.
They call the grays. Are they the same as the rest, or are they different than the rest?
All right, good. What are the grays, and what's the function of the grays, Doctor?
Well, grays is a loose term. The folks from the Zeta Reticuli system, Dr. Wolf talks about the fourth and fifth planets having some races. It is very clear that the large-headed, almond-eyed, large dark-eyed folks with the slanted eyes and so forth are a number of races. They come in a variety of colors. Gray, of course, white, almost off-white, brown, blue, green, orange. Some have three fingers, some have four fingers. Clearly, we're not talking about a single race, so
no,
we're talking about a whole cluster of folks first.
There certainly is a fairly typical description of a gray, though.
Yeah, yeah. But we're talking about lots and lots of varieties, and while skin colors may not be the end of the world, we have a variety of those on Earth.
Well, many believe that the grays are perhaps a service class, that they may be even designed beings, and their place in the hierarchy is not all that high, and they sort of just do jobs.
No. There are some what we might call bioengineered robots that several of the races use to do some of the heavy lifting and the scud work, but the grays are a very high, the various Zeta Reticulan groups are highly evolved, intelligent, spiritual, metaphysically sophisticated folks that are part of the Peace Corps here trying to raise human objectives and functioning. They do some of a lot of the bioengineering effort to get our genome elevated to a higher ticking level, the Star Kid, Star Seed thing.
Well, that sure is what we've been talking about tonight, and so that's sort of full circle. It's been great to have you here. One more time, what's generally available on your website?
A huge amount of information about the star visitors, including a number of intriguing pictures about them that are real, not those monsters you see in the movie or in some lurid magazines, but this is the real deal.
Okay.
When you go there, you can see that. Descriptions of the various races, what the Native American and other indigenous shamans have to say about the star nations among us, what some of the church people have to say, lots of UFO information, some of my research about bases that aren't supposed to exist but do in the Southwest using ET technology, and just a ton of stuff that anybody who goes there and says they're bored, I would have to feel their pulse.
So in other words, those who have been intrigued tonight, obviously many by the phones, really, to follow up, do that. Go to Dr. Boylan's website, which is drboylan, drboylan.com. And from there, you can proceed to perhaps Labored Journey to the Stars, his book. And certainly you can begin to dive in, if you're intrigued enough, and find out more. Fair description, Doctor?
Yeah, and one more thing I would invite people to. Down at the very bottom of the website, you'll see a couple of my electronic newsletters you can get on board. One is just my reports, and one is my reports plus chat among various experiences and star people and others about this whole phenomenon. So if people want to get on there for free and get this information in their mailbox as new things break, they can sign up for either Doc Rich Boylan reports or my UFO facts list.
All this has to cost an awful lot of money. How do you finance all this?
Out of my own pocket.
Out of your own pocket.
Yeah, I don't have some hidden philanthropist pouring money at me. This is bootstrapping.
My friend,
our Star Kids project and the workshops there are bootstrapping. We are self-finance from one thing to the next. And try and keep it very low cost so that people have access.
Gotcha. Doctor, we're out of time. It's been a pleasure.